Welcome to PageCast, a podcast series brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers. By interviewing the authors responsible for some of your most loved books, we explore the thoughts, ideas, emotions, and creative processes that led to the writing of these books. If you're a reader with a zesty interest in people and stories, do stick around and enjoy what PageCast has to offer.
A very warm welcome to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers. My name is Pippa Hudson. I'm the host of the Lunchtime Show on talk radio station Cape Talk, which broadcasts out of Cape Town in South Africa. And it is such a pleasure to be invited onto this podcast to introduce a South African-born writer to you today and to chat about her latest novel, which is set largely in my home country. The Fire Portrait is the third novel published by writer Barbara Mutch, and it is a work of historical fiction set in the early to mid-1900s. The book tells the story of Frances Whittington, a very headstrong and talented young British woman who aspires to a career as a professional artist, but is constrained to a degree by the social norms of the time. Well, that is until an unexpected change of her family's fortunes propels her into a new world where head and heart must compete with her artist's eye to craft a future for herself. Barbara, it's a delight of a read. Welcome to PageCast and welcome back to South Africa. I know you were born and raised here, but home is mainly in the UK these days.
That's right. Thank you, Pippa. It's lovely to be here to talk about The Fire Portrait. Yes, I was born in South Africa. I'm the granddaughter of Irish grandparents who migrated to this country over a century ago. Mm-hmm. So I have Irish stock, but South Africa is my home, although for the most part, I spend quite a lot of each year in the UK.
You do, though, come back regularly.
And, we do.
You have a home here in the Cape, which is, I'm sure, what allows you to write so beautifully and evocatively about the space as you know it today.
Yes.
Before we talk about the book, Barbara, I'm intrigued to know about your journey as a writer, because I believe you were a pharmacist before you took to publishing novels.
I was. I went to Rhodes University and qualified there. And I worked as a pharmacist for about 10 years, then went into various other things, as one does when you have a young family. It's all about juggling. And then when my family and I were transferred to the UK in the mid-90s, I was at somewhat of a loss, and I started to write, I think probably more out of homesickness than anything else. And initially, I thought I was writing a tribute to my Irish grandparents, and I introduced a fictional character. And I realized that it was her story that I wanted to tell. And that became The Housemaid's Daughter, which took about 10 years to come to fruition and was published in 2012. And that was quite difficult because, of course, I'm as a pharmacist and various other things. I had no profile as a writer at all. So it was quite a challenge to find an agent and a publisher who would be prepared to go with somebody with no profile. Mm. So I was lucky. I had timing on my side, as it turned out. And I was lucky enough to meet an agent who was intrigued by my writing.
And with the success of The Housemaid's Daughter, I'm guessing the second publication must have been easier, and the third hopefully still easier after that. Now, The Fire Portrait is at its heart a story of migration. It's the story of outsiders trying to build a life in a new home far from what they know and know to be comfortable and comforting. As you've referenced, you are yourself the granddaughter of Irish migrants. Did their experience, or did any of the sort of family treasure trove of stories of their journey, influence the writing of this book?
Very much so. When I was about 6 or 7 years old, my Irish grandmother, who was a music teacher, taught me to play the piano. And as elderly people do, she loved to reminisce. And she would tell me about what it was like to be a young Irish woman growing, living in Craddock, which is where they settled, and how daunting it was, because like Frances in The Fire Portrait, she didn't speak the local language. So it was very hard to settle. And she used to tell me that she would fantasize that just beyond the kopjes, the rocky kopjes of the Karoo, lay the green hills of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that was something that sustained her. And those memories really stayed with me. So that when I started writing, I imagined what it would be like to arrive in an environment like that, where you are completely on your own, you're isolated, you don't speak the language, you look different, and how you would manage, particularly against the backdrop of historical events that begin to have an impact on the community.
Barbara, of course, at the time you were writing this book, you also had going on around you in your adopted continent of Europe another migration crisis, which I'm guessing probably must have played into your consciousness, the awareness of people desperate to find something better, prepared to put up with all kinds of hardships in the hope that there might be something better at the end of that journey. Did that really compel your character to a degree?
Yes, it did make me think about how we respond to migrants in our community, because Francis in The Fire Portrait really only starts to make headway in her small fictional community of Allo Glen when she offers free art lessons to the local children. She senses a softening amongst the people that she's living with, and she hopes that this will be a way in. But then things change, because this is the 1930s and the world is on the march towards another world war. And Francis's community are very suspicious about what is going to happen and the implications for their young men if South Africa becomes involved on the side of Britain in a world war. Francis finds herself, in fact, once again isolated. And when her husband decides to volunteer on the side of the Allies, she is shunned by her local community.
This community is really caught between two wars, because as much as there is the inevitable march towards World War II, there are also the deep, deep scars left by the Anglo-Boer War. And I think it's worth a sidebar here, Barbara, for those who are not familiar with South African history, just to comment on the deep divisions that that war's legacy left between Afrikaans and English-speaking South Africans.
Very much so. And in fact, it features in the book the treatment of Boer women and children during the Anglo-Boer War was something that still rings true today. And so there were many within the country who felt that they were not prepared to side once again with Britain in any upcoming conflict. In fact, there were a number of people who supported Germany at that time, because Germany had supported the old Boer republics. So it was an awkward situation for Francis. And in fact, when the South African Parliament had to take a vote on whether to declare war, it was a lot tighter than was expected. And there were many who wanted the country to remain neutral. So when the vote went towards South Africa declaring war on Germany and allying with Britain and her allies, it created a schism within the community once again. And Frances, as an Englishwoman, found herself on the wrong side of her community.
You write about the sense of Kitchener's camps and the scorched earth policy and the legacy of that war being forever branded on the soul of these residents.
Yes.
That is a kind of a brand that is carried on from generation to generation in many cases. And there is, without giving away too many plot points, there is that sense of the inevitability of that hatred and division being passed on to the next generation. And yet there is a moment where it is stopped in its tracks in this book, where some members refuse to accept that burden.
That's right. The younger generation actually rise up, and to some degree they rescue Frances from the situation she finds herself in, because I don't think we're giving anything away when we say that a shocking event happens in my fictional town of Allo Glen. And Frances is faced with a choice of being effectively driven out of the community or else staying. And as you mentioned at the start, she's a feisty character. She's not prepared to be booted out, if I could put it that way. And she wants to stay. She's also expecting a child. And she feels that it's important to stay and have her child there and introduce her child to this rather troubled community and hope that somehow that will also put a stamp on her acceptance. But it could go either way.
It could, and that's all I'll say for now. Frances, a wonderful character, very, very sort of independent, spirited and courageous, and when we meet her at the start of the book, champing at the bit at the constraints that society places on her. She's been raised by parents who have doted on her, particularly a father who doted
yes.
on her.
Yes.
A mother quite remote at times, and we understand through the course of the book why that is, but her dad in particular has encouraged her to think for herself, to dream big dreams. At the same time, though, there's no escaping the position of women at this point in history, and she finds herself at a particularly interesting position because First World War has brought changes in the way women navigate society and what they are allowed to do and expected to do, but not that much just yet. This is not the world of Jane Austen, but it's not that far removed from it,
no,
is it?
No, it isn't. And Frances in the 1920s, the late 1920s in England, is expected to get married. Mm. But of course, it is a bit more difficult because the supply, and this sounds awful, but the supply of young men of marriageable age has been decimated by the First World War. So there is competition amongst the young women in Frances's community to land a suitable husband. And Frances doesn't make things any easier because she's not particularly keen on being tied down. So although her mother is desperate for her to make a choice, Frances actually is fairly ambivalent. So when her art teacher gives her an indication that she has sufficient talent, perhaps, to make a career as an artist, she latches onto that. And that is what she wants to do. And she hopes that perhaps she might find a man who would support her in her career. And, well, we'll just have to wait and see for the listeners to
There are some wonderful moments quite early in the book where you think that perhaps she is going to be able to have it all, to navigate those two worlds successfully, and then life gets in the way as it does. I mean, she's got a wonderful restless energy about her as the youngster arriving in the Cape for the first time, and she has this wonderful, quite eccentric aunt who welcomes her, and for the first few months of her stay in South Africa, she's trying to craft that space for herself before
the rug is
ripped from under her.
That's right. I mean, she does meet a potential suitor in Cape Town, and they do fall in love, and she thinks that this could be what she's looking for, someone who will love her but will always support her in her art. And then, as you say, life intervenes, and that opportunity disappears, and Frances is faced with a choice. Does she set sail back for the UK, having failed in her attempt at independence, or does she make a marriage of convenience at the Cape and make what she can of that marriage and of a new life, which takes her to the edge of the Karoo and a town called Aloe Glen?
Now, the Karoo, for the sake of any listeners overseas who are not familiar with South African geography, a very remote semi-desert area. It offers the most magnificent vistas and landscapes of desolation in many places. And it's like that even now. But Barbara, at the turn of the 20th century, it would have been even more isolated and lonelier space. When Frances arrives there, she writes of feeling a sense of being adrift and cast away from everything that is familiar to her. And then there is this wonderful description. She initially finds solace in her artist's eye. She explores the surrounding landscape. She starts discovering that if you look closely, it's not as barren as you think.
There are
all kinds of amazing plants then, and she is a botanical artist. So there is fascination for her there. Mm. And she allows the landscape to open its heart to her.
She does.
She hopes people will.
That's right. She takes a folding stool and she sits in the felt and she draws whatever she can see. And she has to look quite closely because the colours are very cryptic. And it's so different from what she has drawn in the UK, in England. You know, beautiful roses and things like that. And then, of course, she had come to Cape Town and she'd had all the extravagance of the Fynbos and the Proteas. So you're right, Aloe Glen was a real shock to her, not just as a person, but also artistically, because she thought, what am I going to paint here? Mm. And then, as you say, she looks further. She discovers stone plants. She discovers extraordinary aloes, one of which becomes almost her signature piece. It's an aloe which she described as pink and armored with thorns. And she paints it, and it's not been, I don't think, painted before. And she sends the paintings off to the director, who she met unexpectedly, at Kirstenbosch. And he's very intrigued by it and encourages her. And he believes that she will be able to paint subjects which perhaps have not been painted before. So artistically, there are opportunities for her that open up in an area that she never thought would be there for her.
Barbara, the description of her artist's process and the creation of those works is intricate and detailed and suggests a knowledge in the writer of the process of making art. But I understand that's not necessarily the case. You're not an accomplished artist yourself.
I'm not at all. I play the piano. I'm a musician. But I'm not an artist. In fact, I really am hopeless. So it was necessary to take some lessons because I needed to be able to talk about art in an informed manner. I needed to know the vocabulary that Frances would use. I needed to know the equipment that she would use. And, for example, the paint colors that she would employ. And so I went back to look at the catalogues and the historical records of companies that supplied paint to artists in the 1930s and 40s to find out what the paint colors were called. So, for example, things like Viridian Green and Pearl Red, so that I would be able to put those colors on her brush so that she could paint them accurately. But it was a shock for me to have to learn all of this and a real challenge in the book. I also learnt that it was possible to make images with charcoal. And that's all I'm going to say on
the
subject.
Which is very central to a key plot point, for sure. Yes. For sure. We'll leave it at that, though. I have to, though, compliment you on, the immersion in the detail of the artist's world, not only the creative space, but also the commercial element was very interesting for me to read. You know, was it really possible for someone to make a living as a botanical illustrator? You demonstrate in a way how that becomes possible, but also the world of the art auction, the art museums, what becomes of these pieces. It's one thing for the artist to create them. How did you go about researching that aspect?
Well, that was really quite difficult because when I contacted auction houses and I talked about a unique piece of art that had been created in the 1940s and what it would have sold for in the early 1950s, it was difficult to get a figure from them because they wanted to tell me what the art would have been worth today. Mm. Because that, of course, is the key thing. And so it was necessary to do some sort of mathematical calculations and to research further to find out more or less what art sold for in the early 1950s. I discovered that the American art market was much more buoyant than the UK art market, which had suffered greatly during the Second World War, naturally. And some of the auction houses had not survived. So that was a challenge because when Frances's particular work of art is auctioned, the funds that would accrue from that were going to be crucial for her future. So I had to make sure that I got the sums of money correct or as close as possible.
I want to circle back to your fictional town of Aloe Glen. I'm aware of the fact that this is the second novel that you've set in the Karoo. Do you have a particular sense of personal attachment to the area?
I do. Of course, my grandparents arrived in Craddock in the Karoo, and we visited there as a family. I spent holidays in the Karoo. So I know it pretty well. And I also found that the Karoo is, I think in its very starkness, it's rather a metaphor for South Africa. That you have to look hard for the beauty at times. That there is a harshness to it. There is drought. And I found that it was a wonderful backdrop for two of my books. Mm. And Frances, in the end, discovers that as well. She learns to love the Karoo. And I think her father says to her at one stage that the beauty is not obvious. It requires grit and persistence. Mm. And he says, you possess that, Frances, and that's why you've made a success of it.
The other wonderful thing he says to her is to encourage her at that moment. She sets off into this great unknown of her new marriage, that you can still be the person you want to be.
Yes.
And she very much does craft that for herself.
She
by
does.
Her own bootstraps, doesn't she?
She does. And there's an interesting aspect to it as well, because I mentioned earlier, of course, she makes a marriage of convenience. And her husband, Julian, is the local school teacher in Aloe Glen. And at first it is a marriage of convenience. They are fond of each other, but not much more than that. And slowly through the years, in fact, Frances, who originally thought that the marriage of convenience was rescuing her, realizes that actually she has rescued Julian, that Julian is a better man for having married her. So there is a poignancy to that relationship, which is set against, of course, the man that Frances fell in love with in Cape Town, who she lost to someone else. So there is Frances is torn between fondness, genuine fondness and love for Julian, the man she married out of convenience. But also she's still remembering Mark Charlson, with whom she fell in love in Cape Town and who unexpectedly reappears in the book.
And we won't say more
than that.
The one thing we must touch on as well, going back to the subject of division and being torn, we've spoken about the tear, the deep rift between the English and Afrikaans-speaking communities at this point in South African history, but of course also bubbling under, ready to boil over at the end of the Second World War, our racial divisions and the coming apartheid future which lay in store. Now, in the town of Aloe Glen, Frances arrives as an outsider. She doesn't know how things are done. She has a kind of relationship with some of the people who work for her or work in labourer's jobs in the town that is not the norm for the schoolmaster's wife. And really, it forces us to question the concept of just who are the good neighbours in that town, because moment of crisis, they are the ones who
Who step up and come to her aid. And she says at one stage towards the end of the book, after the Second World War is finished, she says, there is a new war to come. And although I don't make a huge amount of it in this book, she recognizes that racial discrimination is going to get worse. One of the characters in the book, who is a particular enemy of her, I suppose you could say, becomes a member of parliament. And of course, South Africa moves towards the system of apartheid. And Frances sees that. And she wonders, what will happen to the community in Aloe Glen, to the people that supported her and who weren't the same color as she was? And so in a way, the book hints at what lies ahead.
Frances looks at everything with the eye of the artist, and she looks deeply, she looks for detail, she looks in where others look away. You could say that she does that socially as well. And in the end, without giving away any plot lines, she forces the town not to look away from itself. There is a confrontation of sorts that happens that really is saying, I wanted them to see were and acknowledge it.
That's right. And Frances, in a way, has what I would call a soft revenge, because she forces people to look inside themselves and to recognize things that they didn't really want to see. And in fact, she has been a catalyst for that. Her very presence in the town is a provocation. And the fact that she is able to put across her views and to be accepted sometimes grudgingly, and sometimes with a whole heart, I think says a lot for her, and also says a lot for the community and the younger members of the community, who in particular see where history is going and see what is going to happen. And they support her. And it's controversial because they are in conflict with their parents' views.
Who was it that said that well-behaved women seldom make history? You've crafted one of those who is prepared to stand up and speak when society would tell you yes. to sit down and be quiet. And actually, early in the book, somebody says it's best to keep a closed mouth and an open mind, particularly when it comes to the legacy of the Anglo-Boer War. Barbara, I mean, do you hope that Frances as a character and that way of seeing the world and refusing to look away will inspire others to consider being a little bit more bold?
I hope it does. I hope it does. You know, when you think of somebody in the late 20s, early 30s, coming to South Africa on her own at the age of 20, in those days, if you didn't like it, you couldn't just go back home, really. You couldn't hop on a plane. So, and that's the same for people setting out on a migration journey these days. It's very, very daunting. So I hope people will read this book and think of Frances as this pioneering young woman who had a vision that she could be an artist, but also, as it turned out, she changed the community that she entered, hopefully for the better.
Barbara, she's going to live in my mind for a long time. I wonder, as the writer, have you let her go and already started brewing the next story and the next character? Or do you let her
I'm going to let her simmer for a year or so and then see what happens. I can't say anything more at this stage.
Well, it's been an absolute delight having you join us on PageCast today. Barbara Much, the author of The Fire Portrait. Her previous two novels are The Housemaid's Daughter and The Girl from Simon's Bay. Lovely to have you back in South Africa to chat to us as well and share the story in the country of your birth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And just one thing to mention to our listeners, I do have quite an extensive website, barbaramuch.com, and you can have a look at that to see more background to all three of the books and reviews and interviews.
The Fire Portrait is available now in all good bookstores and online outlets. There is an e-book version and an audiobook available as well. The novel published by Allison and Busby, it's distributed in South Africa by Jonathan Ball Publishers and retails at roughly 320 Rand in the softcover printed version. And if you've enjoyed listening to this episode of PageCast, just remember that there is plenty more out there. You can find all our previous episodes on your favorite podcast streaming platform. Barbara, much lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of PageCast. We have an incredible lineup of author interviews, so head over to our Facebook and Instagram and follow Jonathan Ball Publishers to stay updated and in the know regarding future episodes. Thanks for your interest in the story behind the story. Happy reading from everyone at PageCast.